You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we interview Tom Llewellyn of Shareable about the creative, cost-effective, and community-building ways that people just like us are sharing everything from housing to ideas to workspaces to tools, appliances, and children's toys. Tune in this week for a great, empowering show about the growing sharing movement.
Shareable has been around since about 2009, kind of reacting to the financial downturn and realizing that sharing could be a really empowering force that was far too often, if not entirely, being left out of the kind of cultural and economic narrative.
Before you with her hands on her hips, she said, I'll accept nothing, loving words from your lips. She said, everything changes with conviction like this. I need you to be good right now. I need you to be good, good, and how. I need you to be love right now. I need you to be love, 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 love.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe, Agwanu, hello and welcome. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawn Land, where it is very chilly lately. And today we're going to focus on some pretty important stuff that we all need to be mindful of as we're moving forward and creating this new way of being with one another. And I have here beside me, as always, my wonderful and incredibly bright and shiny co-host, Ms. Rivera-san.
Thank you, Sherry. I feel a little bit like a copper penny whenever you say something like that. Bright and shiny. I keep my dull side here in my airship in Taos, New Mexico for down days where nobody can see, but I try to shine when I have to show up in the world. So it's nice to rub shoulders with you and polish up from time to time so that we can keep turning that light back out to the places that need it. It is snowy here. It is overcast in the high altitude desert of Taos, New Mexico, and the mountains are just covered with snow right now. This is a blessing, and we always count the blessing of precipitation here in the desert as a Maine-born person. It is a lesson that I have learned to really understand from the people who have lived in the desert for a long time, why they rejoice when the rain falls, why they rejoice when the water comes singing down the acequias and singing down the mountain streams, and what it means to say water is life. I think I took it for granted when I was growing up in very wet Maine, which actually was cracked with a drought this year. So all of these things, our air, our water, our land, are not things we can take for granted anymore. And it requires us to dig a little bit deeper in the training that we've all had as subjects of the corporate consumer state that is called the United States of America, that we need to decolonize our minds and we need to reroute our ways of thinking. And today's show is all about that. We're going to talk with Tom Llewellyn, who is the Strategic Partnerships Director for Shareable.net. And he is a lifetime sharer and commoner based in Canyon, California, which is just outside San Francisco. He lives in a beautiful yurt, and we're going to ask him all sorts of questions about the 1001 ways that you and me and our next door neighbors can start to reduce our individual ownership and start to share more, both in large system ways and things as small as talking to our neighbors and borrowing a screwdriver. So welcome to the show, Tom. And Sherry, why don't you ask the first question?
Tom, it's wonderful to have you with us, and I'm wondering if you can tell me and our listeners just the basics, Shareable 101. What can you give us to help us understand the larger context in which you're working?
Sure. So Shareable has been around since about 2009, kind of reacting to the financial downturn and realizing that sharing could be a really empowering force that was far too often, if not entirely, being left out of the kind of cultural and economic narrative. And so the idea was that we wanted to create a place for that. We wanted to make sure there was a voice. And in the last 7 years, Shareable has really kind of lived into being this nonprofit media outlet and action network that is empowering people to share and doing it to really increase resilience and equity and to bring about joy in the people that are participating. And so we primarily inspire change by publishing solutions-based news stories and analysis, but also spend a lot of time working on how-tos and working with community groups to coordinate sharing initiatives in their communities and events and kind of support the local sharing infrastructure that's already there in addition to starting new things. And we've felt that we've had a pretty good success doing that so far, and we're really looking forward to the next few years to kind of amplify that even more. Shareable as an organization, as a publication, really exists because there was already a movement that was going on there. When we first started, the idea was to kind of help to catalyze a movement around sharing. And very, very quickly, we realized that that movement was already there. It just wasn't really being spoken about or not spoken about on a national or international scale in the way that it deserved to be. And so now we spend a lot of our work just finding those stories and telling the stories of the tool libraries and the time banks and the community gardens and the worker-owned cooperatives and the incredible policy initiatives that are going on and telling stories that are replicable and so that others will be inspired and bring them to their communities. And then we kind of, when the Action Network kind of comes in, we work to help connect people together and kind of create this. We've been working creating this community of learning and of sharing to kind of push the sharing movement forward. And so that's kind of what's going on. And it's really growing. I think that people want connection. People want to feel like they're doing something in their communities. They want to work locally and feel like they're making a global impact. And there's a lot of ways to do that right now. And it's far easier to get connected than maybe it's ever been using the technology that we have. So it's an exciting time for sharing of all kinds.
So what was your pathway to this work? How did you become involved in not only the programmatic work, but in this movement connected to sharing?
Well, I was blessed to grow up commenting in the United States, something that many people don't get. And I grew up and have recently returned to a small community in the woods behind Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area of about 225 people kind of hidden out here. And we manage all of our roads in common. We have water systems that we manage in common, mesh networks for our high speed internet that we've set up as a community. You know, I got to grow up paving the road every year and getting an understanding of what it takes to maintain those resources, but then also participating in community governance, where we have a community association that we make decisions around water and around land use, and that we work through for internal conflict management, and really do our best to manage the community without very much outside interference or support. And so that's kind of given me kind of my understanding of the commons, but then also the idea of what can happen when there isn't a group of people that is standing up to support their communities and to protect their resources. The community is situated in a redwood grove where 150 years ago or so, every single tree was cut. You know, not a single old growth was left. And so while the trees are large, you know, being 100 years old, 150 years old, we were left with a number of the stumps and really getting that understanding of legacy and the lack thereof in many instances. I mean, they even had cut down these two giant redwood trees that were at the top of the hill that ship captains used to navigate how to get into the bay before there was the Golden Gate and before there was other navigation systems. And they could see it far out in the ocean and find the entrance to the San Francisco Bay. And those trees were cut. Now there's a plaque. You know, really that paved paradise and put up a parking lot is something that I've seen and lived. And so I was inspired to take action and to protect. And so before coming to Shareable, I spent many years co-leading a project called the Sustainable Living Roadshow, where we traveled around the country educating around sustainability at universities and at music festivals and community events and reservations and kind of wherever we were called to come. And through that work, I was inspired by all of the amazing projects and initiatives that existed and also humbled by the challenges at hand and really learning and being able to tell the stories of people going through very similar struggles in communities all across the United States. And coming out of that work, I was inspired to start new sharing projects and do community asset mapping and help other communities do the same. And up to this point, I have co-launched a community center in Oakland that we did with the Sustainable Living Roadshow called A Place for Sustainable Living, which has a shared fabrication lab and for many years had a bike kitchen, which has since outgrown our space and moved into its own at this point in time. So we're able to incubate that community space and kind of a urban sustainability model. And then in addition to that, I've co-founded the Asheville Tool Library in North Carolina and been associated with a number of other sharing initiatives as well. And as I went to help other communities to do the same, I got connected with Shareable. And there was an opportunity to, instead of doing that through my own organization, to join forces, as it were, and support Shareable in that work. And so that kind of brought me to that point. And for the last 3 years, I've been working with Shareable to really work with communities and to empower their local sharing movements.
Tom, you mentioned that this is a movement that pre-existed Shareable, but Shareable has helped to amplify the voice of the movement and the ideas and kind of grow everything in a very fertile, interconnected way. My question is, how fast is this movement growing worldwide? I think it's growing very rapidly, but my specific thought was in the U.S., where we are all located, and many of our listeners, most of our listeners are. And is it generational? Is there a generational bend to who shares and why they share and how they share and what kind of projects appeal to which? I saw on the Shareable website that there's a Gen Y's guide to sharing, but there's no like millennials guide to sharing or baby boomers. Maybe there is a baby boomers guide to sharing and I missed it. But what are the kind of generational dynamics and attitudes about ownership and sharingship? Is that a word, sharingship? Is this a growing trend that we're seeing throughout the U.S. of people kind of catching on to the idea that we don't all have to have our own lawnmower?
You know, it is interesting. I think that it's cross-generational. I think that we are all social creatures and sharing is a big part of that. There's all different levels. There's the formal sharing, there's the informal sharing. And I think, you know, looking at the millennial side of it, it's very much technology based. I mean, we've seen the power of apps to connect people and to exchange goods and to be able to get services, you know, on demand through apps. And kind of that technological advance has really helped kind of grow sharing in general. It has allowed people to connect in real time in ways that weren't possible otherwise. But it's not really limited to that. I mean, we've seen the transition movement, which we have a number of groups that we partner with Transition US and a number of the groups that we are working on for Sharing Cities projects are completely integrated with transition groups. And they tend to be of an older generation, a lot of boomers involved in transition across the country. And then in the middle as well, I mean, we often kind of ignore or don't really think about like babysitting cooperatives and groups that are set up and all different parents that are involved in sharing in one way or another in that way. Church groups and how for so many people of faith, sharing and supporting one's community is such a core part of that religious practice. So I don't think that it's limited in any way. and again, you're asking about how fast it's growing. You know, just one prime example is tool libraries, where people can check out tools just like they would a book from a library, libraries of things. And in the U.S., just about 5 years ago, I think there was about 20 active tool libraries. And in the last 5 years, that's gone from 20 to 70 or close to it. I get emails every day from people that are starting a new tool library in the United States and in Canada. There's a very active kind of online group of people that are doing that work and supporting each other to start more. I mean, the city of Portland, I think, has about 5 tool libraries at this point. And that has been enabled by the software, that the technology that makes it really easy to keep track and to loan out tools. And it wasn't nearly as easy to run one. I mean, there's been tool libraries. The first one was opened in Cleveland, Ohio in 1978. I believe the second one was in the city of Berkeley, and it's the longest running. It's been open ever since. But it's been running through the city library. And now we're seeing a number of city libraries that are starting tool libraries and integrating that into their library system, as well as a lot of just kind of nonprofit groups that are doing it as well. And it's been a great kind of very tangible example of sharing. And at the same time, the time bank movement has been steadily growing for the last number of years, and I've been heartened to find out that the largest time bank in the world is actually in Istanbul with 40,000 members. And you think about, I mean, there's millions of people in the city, but 40,000 people have opted in to share their skills that are just waiting to be asked to help. And that, to me, is very encouraging, but it's also just a great example of kind of the place that sharing has.
Tommy, you know, I think it's really interesting that we've begun to do a really good job as human beings to learn to share with one another, to reduce our need for stuff, to reduce our impact. And I had an interesting thought as you were talking about what is our responsibility to recognize that we also share this world with the rest of creation, that there is a whole living world out there that does not include human beings, that we also share this earth with. And what is our responsibility towards sharing with the rest of the natural world? And curious if you've had any opportunity to look at anything like that in the programming you've done. If so, what does that look like? And if not, what might it look like to create some type of awareness around that responsibility towards sharing as well?
So one of the best examples, I think, of that going that I've been a part of to this point is the kind of the permaculture movement. The idea that we need to be both feeding the soil and the biome while we are taking nutrients for ourselves. And it's both that fair share model, returning the surplus to the land itself and supporting it so that it supports us. So it is also in our own personal best interests. But the idea is very conscientious of exactly what you're talking about. And I think that throughout the rest of the sharing economy, that's been lost. There isn't a lot of focus on that. There was a study that was done a couple of years ago by Juliet Shore in Boston, who is a noted sharing economy researcher. And her research found that services like Airbnb that provide, you know, cheaper accommodations, and we can get into that in a moment about kind of some of these different sharing economy companies that are out there, but that it can actually increase the environmental impact. It is increasing environmental impact because it is making travel cheaper and easier for people to do. And so just because we are engaging in sharing or in the larger, you know, sharing economy doesn't necessarily mean that we are acting more environmentally as much as we are kind of acting more in our own personal best interest. So there's a lot more that needs to be done there. And as I said, besides working in permaculture, I haven't seen a lot of focus put on the larger environment and the, you know, other species that we share this planet with, sometimes not so nicely. The just other example would be in the commoning relationships. When there are very well managed and governed commons, that is often part of that, the idea of preserving this resource, because it's not as short-sighted as our kind of capitalist market system often treats resources. There is an understanding that these common resources, these common pools, have been utilized and maintained for hundreds, if not thousands, of years before now, and they are seen to be needed to be maintained for hundreds, if not thousands, of years from now. And so there is larger consciousness around that support for the natural world, as opposed to our often unnatural experience within the natural world.
You know, it's interesting. We've had a number of guests on our radio show who have explored sort of dimensions of this. And one guest comes to mind who was talking about wild backyard gardening. And actually one of the sharing elements of that is the sharing of skills and knowledge about wild plants. But their area outside of Chicago had connected a international, continental-long wildlife corridor for birds and other aviatory species like bees and butterflies. And so I think that it will be very interesting as we start to explore the dimension that Sherry brings up and we start to really integrate that deeper into the sharing economy. I think people do get into it from whatever perspective they're coming from. And many people, it's economic, it's a shortage of time, or it's a need for connection and community. But I think the deeper we go in it, the more we find these elements of reevaluating ourselves as a species, reevaluating who we are as human beings, looking at democracy and governance again, because that's very much entwined in many of the sharing platforms. And as we're talking about that, let's go back to Airbnb and Uber and these kind of like giant sharing companies. I just want to bring up the shadow side of them. They came on like huge companies that grew super fast, and many cities are really struggling with the downside of them, the kind of layers that people didn't expect. Uber drivers are not unionized, or they're just starting to be unionized. There are cities like Austin and I believe Portland, Oregon, who have kicked Uber out, or it's more accurate to say required Uber to actually meet the standards of their other taxi drivers, and so Uber refuses to do that, so they can't come in. But Airbnb has now been criticized quite heavily, and often quite rightly, for driving up the rental prices in cities so that people who are trying to rent to live in the city can't afford to live there anymore because everyone who has a second house is renting it out on Airbnb. Would you be willing to explore some of the shadow side of some of these sharing ideas and concepts? And do you think they were intentional? Do you think they were foreseen? Do you think they have arisen and are something that we all have to grapple with? I would just like to explore kind of the dimension that is not so fuzzy feeling as the library of things.
Yeah. Well, you've said it pretty well just right there. You know, there are a lot of examples of these sharing economy behemoths, really monopolistic companies. It really doesn't feel very much like sharing. You know, it's really just sharing in name, so much so that there's a pivot almost sometimes with these companies to be talking about on-demand service or collaborative consumption. There's a number of different names that get thrown around, but for most people, there's just the blanket sharing economy. And for the work that we do at Shareable, I really like to focus more on the idea of the sharing movement more than the sharing economy. I think that kind of limits the scope and understanding of what's going on to just being economical, as opposed to all the social and environmental aspects of a lot of real sharing. But this kind of the shadow side is very present. These companies have gotten very big, very, very fast. These, especially the two that you've said, Airbnb and Uber, and there's starting to be a fair amount of backlash. We saw in San Francisco last year, there was an initiative to try to regulate Airbnb more, and Airbnb spent millions of dollars and just narrowly defeated it. We've seen a lot of places all around the country that have very little, a very small housing stock, housing that is not currently being rented or lived in. And so when you have a very small amount of available housing, like a puzzle pieces. You have to get in there just the right time. And if there's any large taking away from that, then it can cause a lot of problems. And we've seen, I think, in San Francisco, Airbnb is taking up much of the available, quote unquote, available housing stock, these short term rentals. And there's also lots of other things that are not always, if you don't look very closely, you don't see them. But there's a lot of racism that can take place on these platforms where people are judging who they're willing to stay with or who they're willing to rent to by looking at a picture, by looking at a profile and making those kinds of judgments. And so there's bias involved. Same thing with Uber coming in and really disrupting the taxi industry, which there's been a long standing issues with taxis and taxis, you know, not necessarily picking up people of color or anything else, but by law they're supposed to. And Uber is not under that same law. Uber drivers can choose whether or not they respond and what neighborhoods they'll pick people up from, what neighborhoods they'll take people to, and a number of cities that have the taxi systems are being compromised. There's a chance that their taxis will go out of business completely because of these, like Uber and Lyft and others that are coming in. And that will mean that there's whole swaths of the population that are going to be at risk to not be able to have adequate mobility resources. So there's some concerns there. And at the same time, though, there's some exciting things that are coming about as a result of these larger platforms, and I think there's some benefits to them that aren't always talked about. Not that I am personally a supporter of Uber and Airbnb as companies and their business practices and what they're doing, but what one of the side positive side effects, I will just say, is that they have, because they've become so mainstream and they have now become an accepted form of transportation, an accepted form of housing, they have kind of taken away the stigma of people offering rides or in staying in individuals, you know, other people's houses when traveling. And that's a really positive thing. That is going to make it possible for kind of the next wave of the sharing economy that's coming, that we're already seeing. You mentioned Austin. And when Austin decided to enforce the regulations they have on the taxi industry onto Uber and Lyft, Uber, instead of trying to comply, Uber and Lyft pulled out overnight. They shut down operations completely. All these people their drivers, which had been working for them, lost their jobs overnight. The people that became reliant upon their service lost that service overnight. But what's happened is a number of new companies have come about. And two of them that are great examples, one of them is Arcade City. And what we're seeing is that instead of following the same kind of top-down, classic capitalist, business, venture capitalist-driven, Silicon Valley-enabled business structure that Airbnb and Uber are both following. These companies are looking at greater cooperative structures, and they are enigmatic of the new movement for platform cooperatives. Like in Austin, where the new rideshare companies are owned by the drivers. And we've seen another example of not just straight cooperative, but what's known as an ESOP, which is an employee stock option program company. Juno is coming up in New York City, where all of the drivers are getting essentially partial stock ownership. And so if the company ever goes public, they will benefit from their labor, from growing that brand. And this kind of larger platform cooperative movement in just the last 2 years has gained an incredible amount of ground. There's now been two conferences in New York City, one last November and one just 2 weeks ago that Shareable was a part of putting on, to kind of highlight this movement. And whereas the conference in last November, a year ago in New York about platform co-ops was really just to kind of announce the fact that they were existing and that there was to get energy behind it, the event that took place just a couple of weeks ago was looking at kind of the getting down to business and making it all happen. And a number of representatives from cities around the world all came together, policymakers and community advocates and business owners all came together, and it was more of a practicum than just talking. And so this is really exciting.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence. You knew it all ended tomorrow. On this week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to deviate from our usual routine of history or strategy to pull something directly off of shareable.net that we felt was an extremely helpful basic how-to get started with sharing. This piece was written by Stephanie Smith and posted on the website. She wrote it in reply to someone on her blog post who asked, "What do you do if you live in a conservative Midwestern town where sharing is seen as a threat or a huge no-no?" And she says, "Great question. How do you begin? If you happen not to be in one of those hotbeds of sharing innovation like Portland, Oregon, or Berkeley or Oakland, California, or Brooklyn, New York, how do you start sharing and with whom in a way that gives you the most chance of success?" Here are a few of her ideas on getting started. First, get in tune with the sharing that already happens around you. Sometimes we don't have to buck trends or pester neighbors in order to start sharing. Remember when you gave a friend a ride to the airport, or shared oranges from your tree with a next-door neighbor, or participated in a bake sale at your church, or checked out a book from the library? Not everyone formalizes it by calling it resource sharing, but we share informally all the time. Notice these sharing behaviors, champion them, and build on them. Second, decide if you're a natural starter or a joiner. To get resource sharing beyond the borrow a cup of sugar from a neighbor stage requires a bit of research, planning, and oversight, not to mention some cajoling. Are you the kind of person who enjoys spearheading this kind of effort? If so, dive right in. If not, consider partnering with someone who is. But don't worry, once a sharing group, like a childcare co-op, a buying club, or a tool lending library, is up and running, it needs less starting and more tending. Many groups who reach this point choose to spread the ongoing management responsibilities among their members. Third, save time and start efforts with people and institutions that do not need to be convinced. This idea makes sense, especially for folks in rural areas. Many institutions like churches or schools, community centers, and libraries hold values and have actual physical space that already supports sharing. Develop sharing programs inside these strongholds and work outwards into the wider circles in your community. Fourth, use saving money as a reason for getting started. Few people can resist this practical excuse to start sharing. Show your friends and neighbors on paper how much money they might save if you all started sharing. Fifth, sit down and talk. Face-to-face time, especially over food, is the key to community building and neighborhood-based resource sharing. Have a potluck. Sit down with a few neighbors, extended family members, or friends, share a meal, and simply talk about this topic. You're likely to be amazed by the ideas that come up, the feelings of goodwill that arise, and the sense of rightness that will emerge from this experience, as if everyone is taking a deep breath. We humans are actually communal by nature, and this may very well feel like coming home. And lastly, stay inspired. Creating a resource-sharing-based society will take time. The more passionate we are about the benefits of resource-sharing and community building, the more stamina we'll likely have. Search shareable.net for more stories about resource-sharing pioneers and share your own in the comments section of the website. In addition, you can check out their useful how-to section, which has numerous stories about how to start a tool library or how to share bicycles. They even have a top 20 how to share post page, which includes things on how to be a car-free family, how to barter, give, and get stuff, how to start a really, really free market, how to share a chicken or two, how to start your own Skillshare, how someone avoided holiday shopping through a donation exchange, that ought to be timely and relevant, how to start a farmer's market, how to throw a community swap meet, how to swap cities, how to share a nanny, how to host a baby food swap. One mother says it saved her sanity and fed her child. You can find things on the 20 tips, including how to share a cow, how to share time, how to legally open a gift economy, how to start a housing cooperative, a vegetable garden, or how your nonprofit can share down their costs. There's ideas for everyone on this website, and the list goes on and on. As you can see, there's lots of tips and advice from people who are doing this work all over the country. So perhaps your first step is actually to go and dig a little deeper and find out how people are doing this just like you. All these great ideas and the feeling of solidarity is why we share these little nonviolent segments in the middle of Love and Revolution Radio each week. Have a blast and keep on sharing.
There's all different types of platform co-ops, and another one that I'll just look at is kind of an alternative to TaskRabbit, which is another large company that's oftentimes put in the same bucket as Uber and Airbnb, where on TaskRabbit, people can sign up to do odd jobs. They could be ministerial, they could be cleaning, driving, anything, you know, task. But what happens with it, very similar to Amazon's Mechanical Turk program, is that people underbid each other to try and get the jobs. And so it has a lot of negative effects when it comes on the laborers, where people are having to say, okay, no, I'm going to, instead of my hourly rate for this job, which is worth $20 an hour, I'm going to do it for 15. And then somebody says, no, I'll do it for 10. And somebody says, no, I'm desperate, I'll do it for 8. This is something that we're seeing happening. And the founders of that platform didn't anticipate that. And they have voiced their disappointment in the fact that is what is happening with the company that they've started. But there's alternatives to that are being built up. And we've got one in the San Francisco Bay Area that has been working for a number of years and is still trying to, you know, get enough users to be profitable and to continue to grow. But it's called Localnomics. And it's the exact same idea, where people are able to sign up to do tasks, except they also become part owners of the company. And as the company grows and the company makes more profit, all the different people on that platform that are providing service will have a direct benefit.
Tom, some of the problems that you noted are not problems that are unique to this movement. These are problems that are large scale social problems that we're all facing. And one of the things that I often find somewhat encouraging when I hear about some of these challenges that are being faced is that these problems are being brought to unique populations of people, which gives them a unique opportunity to look at them in a microcosmic way and to address them and hopefully find solutions to them that may be harder to find when looking at them on the larger scale. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we have these movements that are cropping up, where you have distinct populations of people that are drawn to them, that they give us a really remarkable opportunity to learn how to engage one another in different ways. They give us opportunities to face and to solve some of the problems socially that we have, such as, you know, racism or gender discrimination or orientation discrimination or socioeconomic discrimination, and allows us to do so within a context that is personally relevant for us, whereas, you know, we can get lost in the larger scheme of things and then people can become pretty complacent about the struggles that other people are having when we have these microcosmic opportunities to address some of these issues in work that we're engaged in that is somehow meaningful to us. We have more incentive to engage them. And so as you're watching some of these things unfold and watching them kind of play out, have you seen any changes, any shifts that have resulted from that work that might give you hope to being able to translate that into a larger format where we can take some of the successes that might come out of this work and apply them to different scenarios? Is there any examples that you can think of that might be replicable in other areas where people have been forced to face some of these issues within a small sphere of influence and have been able to address them successfully?
There really are. One of the benefits of our work is that we get to learn about solutions from all over the world. And so one of the main focuses that we've been of Shareable over the last year has been compiling a lot of these examples of kind of the worker cooperative business development initiatives in New York and how to tackle vacant buildings in Amsterdam and the work against foreclosure that has been so amazing in Richmond, California, different co-op taxis like we were talking about and amazing kitchen libraries and reactions to very, very positive reactions to immigrant crises and how communities have pulled together to support people coming in on boats from you know, refugees coming in from Syria into Crete and Athens and everywhere else. And there's just so many examples of that. But we, like you were saying, it's very hard to connect with those and see the relevance and unless they're right there in front of you, it's hard to figure out how to take steps to do similar projects, to start similar initiatives in your own community. And so we've been working with a group of about 23 people around the world to put together a book and action guide around sharing cities and the commons and sharing. And we will be releasing our book, Sharing Cities, Activating the Urban Commons, in early next year. And the book is made up of about half model policies. These are mostly existing policies that are taking place around the world. Some of them are very high level or very well thought out policy recommendations, like from the Sustainable Economies Law Center, which has a very strong policy recommendation for cities on how to regulate Airbnbs, you know, or just any kind of short-term rentals, really. Airbnb just being the most noted company behind short-term rentals. But the book that we're working on is looking at 11 different sectors, being work, housing, mobility, food, finance, governance, communications, land management, water, waste, and energy. And we're really excited to be offering that to the world and kind of offering that those very tangible examples. And that's why we felt like the case studies were really important, and also those policy tools, and feel like they will be a great complement to the, you know, couple hundred how-tos that we have on our site and all the other pieces of research and articles that we present.
Well, that's exciting, Tom. And I know I'm already looking forward to reading it, and I'll definitely be getting a copy. Tom, one of the things that I'm most curious about in the whole sharing movement is this thing called sharing cities that seem to be popping up all over the world and just are really approaching the city as a political and social body of where we start to really get these concepts of sharing on the ground in our communities. Will you talk a little bit about what's going on with the sharing cities, where they are, how much they're growing, what are some of the programs that people are doing?
Sure. So cities are incredible just because how dynamic they can be. They can be harder to pass referendums on the state level and to rely on national policy. But cities can implement things and try things out. They're centers of innovation. And so a lot of cities around the world have decided, you know, much like there's the smart cities movement and being, you know, sustainable cities and other platforms like that, the idea of becoming a sharing city has become really attractive. And it kind of was launched in part by Shareable in our work. Back in 2011, we hosted ShareSF, which was kind of the first sharing economy conference. And we had members of City of San Francisco there. And they ended up kind of creating an innovation team to work on sharing and city policy following that. And partially coming out of that, the city of Seoul, South Korea, became really interested. They were dealing with the high levels of poverty and a very high suicide rate, general unhappiness upon their citizens as they industrialized very, very quickly without having a lot of kind of the social safety nets to support people that were left out of that development. And so they've become kind of the bastion for sharing cities around the world, and have the mayor of Seoul, Mayor Park, has made it one of the key parts of his administration to make Seoul a sharing city. And a lot of cities have become influenced by that. They're recently just had a big conference about their sharing city just a few weeks ago, actually. And cities around the world are starting to become sharing cities as well. Amsterdam has become the first official sharing city. And what's interesting is that not only are cities taking note and starting to take action, unions have gotten involved and are advocating for it as well. I just had a meeting recently with one of the main unions in Denmark who had come to California to learn about sharing cities and the sharing economy and the future of work. And they're looking at how, as a union, they can support this growth in Denmark.
I'm looking at the city directory list, and there's a very impressive list internationally. But to my surprise, and I have to admit a little cynicism here, there are close to, I think, 30 or more sharing cities in the United States, including Austin, Texas, Atlanta, Georgia, Boston, Massachusetts, Boulder, Colorado, Chicago, Illinois, Detroit, Michigan. The list goes on, and I have to confess to being quite heartened by this. I mean, isn't sharing like anti-American to some people's minds? Isn't it like a communist brainwashing thing? How has this list grown so enormously? And has there been any pushback to the idea of a sharing city?
Sure. So what you're looking at on our site at shareable.net is our listing of the Sharing Cities Network. And this list comprises some programs that are being led by cities themselves and then also citizen initiatives. And at this point, most of those initiatives that you're looking at that are located within the United States are citizen initiatives, groups that have come together to try to shed light on and cultivate sharing projects within their cities. Some of these cities have policy work going on. Some of them are focused on specific projects, and some of them are creating local networks, and others are doing all of the above. So one of the things that we've done with Shareable is that we've worked with groups to map out all of their community resources as kind of the first step towards starting to kind of move up the ladder of becoming a sharing city, just to find out, you know, what is there. And almost every single time people are surprised to see that, you know, there is a tool library, you know, that there's, I think, about 70 across the United States at this point in time. So many cities have tool libraries. All the community gardens, all the farmers market are there, the credit unions, the public health clinics, both above ground sharing initiatives and kind of more informal sharing initiatives that are present. And then one of the things that we've been doing over the last number of years is working with local community groups to then network all of those groups together to be able to advocate for the cities to kind of get on board and support this growth. And so some cities have really been moving. In Bloomington, Indiana, for one example, they have a wonderful project where they have time banks and tool libraries and have also done a lot of work with trying to get good policy passed for the city as well. And so that's kind of a comprehensive group. And Share Bloomington is a group that's come out of that. In other places, like in Amsterdam, for example, the city has on board and they have actually hired the grassroots groups that started to do an official city index of all of the resources so that the city will have access to that. And they're doing that right now. And they're working on replicating that indexing methodology for other cities to implement the same thing around the world. So it's this mixing of kind of grass tops and grassroots work that's taking place that really is making sharing cities what they are.
Another question that I have, Tom, is I heard about the city commons or the state commons partnerships here in the U.S. Many people are catching on to, and other people are still unaware that we have private-public partnerships, which are generally not working out so well in favor of the people. I have to confess my bias and my opinion on that subject. But in other parts of the world, I believe I was reading about this in Italy and perhaps Spain, the city or the state is contracting not with a private company, but with a commons-based or cooperative-based organization. Something that in the commons is important in this because it is actually owned collectively of, by, and for the people. Can you speak a little bit about that?
It's interesting. I was actually just at an event where I was presenting about the commons just a couple of weeks ago in Northern California. And it was at a university, but there was both students and non-students at this conference. half of the attendees really either didn't know what the commons were, had only just heard of them, and didn't have a very strong, you know, understanding or grasp, that's for sure. And I think that's pretty normal in the United States. In the United States, we really have the private sector and the government sector, and that's it. But that's not how a lot of places around the world are set up, where there's a third sector, which is the commons. And there's forests and fisheries and public lands that are really public lands and not even government managed. It was interesting to learn more about that. I was at a speaking event in Spain not long ago, and just hearing about how there were still very large forests across Spain that were being managed by all of the people that lived around them without really any government interference or support when it came to deciding, you know, how much wood could be harvested and, you know, what could be planted, the various uses of the medicinal plants and the protection of the sustainability of those forests were all being managed by the communities that were using them. And there's actually, it's been estimated that about 2 billion people around the world are getting all or part of their subsistence from commons of this kind. So it's not as small or as fringe as it would appear here in the United States.
Wow, that is really quite a remarkable number, and I'm going to really sit back and reflect on that. As we mentioned at the top of the show, I do live in Taos, New Mexico, and of course, New Mexico has one of the more interesting commons-based systems, the acequias, the irrigation ditches, that were originally, some of them were built by the indigenous peoples and then expanded on and developed much further by the Spanish colonists, and they are maintained as a commons-based system to this day. So I like that you make the point that the commons and these sharing modalities are here. They're very viable. One of the cities on the list is Santa Cruz, California, where I lived for many years. I was a member of a bicycle messenger cooperative, which was a member organization of a bicycle tool co-op, which expanded then into things like there was a sewing tool co-op, there was a computer tool co-op, there was a toy library. And it really does help to not just create a more robust and resilient and interesting community, but work directly on economic inequality and economic injustice by intervening in the lack of access to resource that many people have.
That idea of the library of things that you've brought up has actually been a core part of the work that is being done in Seoul, South Korea as well, where they have started to put in libraries of things in their new high-rise developments. In Seoul, it's referred to as a mega city. I think 7 million people live there. And they have high-rise buildings that there's 2,000 people, 2,500 people living in a single building, you know, that could be an entire community. And so one of the things that the mayor's council has started to do is do in two different districts, they are trialing adding in libraries of things to many of their high-rise and making it be a part of any new high-rises that are being constructed so that the residents have access to things and don't have to own everything. They've seen that it's very practical on that sense. And they're also seeing the community benefit of people sharing the same resources and communicating over the use of those and managing those kind of in common as well. So the library of things, I think is already growing around the world, but I think it's going to be growing. It's going to be growing even more in the next few.
I want to remind the listeners that this is Tom Llewellyn that we're speaking with. He's the Strategic Partnerships Director for Shareable.net, which is a great place to find out more about all of this stuff. He's a lifetime sharer and commoner. And Tom, what are some very last brief words or a place that you like to reference people to go find out more?
I would just recommend that people start with what they're passionate about and go from there and find people in your communities that are passionate about it too, so you're not doing it by yourself. It's so much more fun when we do it together. And when you are looking for ideas or you have an idea and you want to figure out how to do it, come over to shareable.net, and we've got about 200 different how-tos for starting all sorts of different sharing projects, and can not only offer you those how-tos and those tools to do it yourself, but we can also help connect you to people that are doing very similar things all around the world.
Great, and thank you for joining us on Love and Revolution Radio.
You're welcome. No, it's great to have you, and I look forward to continuing to listen to your program.
Thank you, Tom. It's been great to meet you here.
Thanks this week to our guest, Tom Llewellyn, and thanks to Sherry Mitchell for her wonderful questions and for all of her comments on previous shows that have really expanded our thinking in terms of the way different cultures also address how we own or share our common resources together. Our theme song is Love and Revolution with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. We thank her for sharing this song with us week after week, and you can find her music at www.dianepatterson.org.
I'd also like to thank my co-host, Ms. Rivera-Sun, for her depth and for always finding us interesting guests to be on the show. I have to admit that she does the lion's share of booking for the program, and I appreciate the wisdom that she brings to the choices that she makes on who to bring on the show with us. If you've enjoyed this show and some of the things that I've shared, you might also enjoy the things that I post on my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. All you have to do is give them a call and ask them. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera-Sun's website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera-Sun. From tool co-ops to libraries of things to babysitting cooperatives, Tom Llewellyn has done a great job of sharing some of the 1,001 ways that we can be sharing in our world. But as Tom says, we should start right where we are and where our passion is. So perhaps, listeners, you'll find something as small as a cup of sugar or a crescent wrench to share with someone else by the time we talk to you next week.